Okay, so today we're kind of talking more about a concept or a process than a specific historical event in our movies here. So we're going to use kind of both The Artist and Singing in the Rain to talk about Hollywood's transition from the silent era to the talkie era, because as a history podcast looking at movies, for us, this is a significant historical cultural milestone. So we want to kind of dive in and do this justice. And it's kind of fun, too. And if we have time, we'll throw in the jazz singer as well. And the year 1927 is kind of like the featured year for all three of these movies. So it's going to be kind of fun to look at that year historically here. So I did watch all three of those movies. Did you have time to watch more than just The Artist? We kind of said you were going to kind of be point man on The Artist. I'd be point man on Singing in the Rain, and then we'll kind of go from there. But I did try to watch. I did watch all three.
I only watched The Artist.
That's fine, and that's fine. And because all these stories are fictional, but the events they cover are not. Well, wait. Or sorry, the time period is very real. And people in Hollywood were going through this, but the specific people we get in these movies are fictional. And they kind of run the gamut. So yeah, like Singing in the Rain is a 100/95 on Rotten Tomatoes. And it actually surprised me. It was only nominated for two Oscars. Score and Supporting Actress for Jean Hagen. So she's not the lead female role, Debbie Reynolds. She's the one who's the actress who looks great in silent films, but talks like this when it's time to go to talkies. And so it doesn't work. Have you ever seen Singing in the Rain before?
I have, a long time ago, but I have seen it, yeah.
Okay. So the line, they're even trying to get her to, like, they say it over and over again, which is why it stands out. They're trying to get her to say, like, I can't stand him. And she's just like, yeah. I can't stand him. Like, it just, she just can't talk. And then so the whole conceit of the film is eventually they have Debbie Reynolds dub her voice, so when they can do these talkie films and have the actress who's been the star all along, and then they have the behind the scenes person doing the voiceover, and we'll talk more about that a little bit too. But yeah, I can't believe you just kind of assume Singing in the Rain, because it's number 87 all time on IMDb's top 250. It shows up a lot on best films of all time. It's a lot of fun. I think before I'd ever watched Singing in the Rain, I kind of assumed it was going to be, like, serious or just kind of a musical drama, you know, or like romantic or something like that. It's like, it's basically straight up a comedy. And then The Artist won Best Picture, and I'm trying to remember what year. Do you have the stats on the Oscar or on The Artist for its Oscars and Rotten Tomatoes?
So it came out in 2011, and it won Best Picture, Best Director. And then, how do you say that lead guy's name?
Oh, man, I don't have it in front of me. It's like Darjean, or I actually don't have the name in front of me.
If I were just reading in my head, I read it as Jean Dujardin, but I'm pretty sure that that's not how you say it.
Right. So it's probably Jean Dujardin.
Yeah, he's a French guy.
Yeah.
But anyway, he got Best Actor. And then it got Best Costume Design and Best Score.
Yeah, so general thoughts. You'd seen The Artist before, I'm sure.
Yeah, I saw The Artist either the year that it came out or maybe the year after. I didn't see it in theaters, but
okay.
It's good. It's pretty good. I don't know. I'm pulling up the. It's being kind of slow to load. I was pulling up to see what else was nominated that year, or what else came out that year to see how it would stack up. I don't know if you had been doing your top tens at that time.
Actually, I was. Yeah, let me pull that up.
So, I guess rewatching it this time, I don't know if it was just because I wasn't really in the mood for it that I didn't really connect with it that much watching it again. I remember liking it relatively well the first time I watched it, but this time it seems like it, not that it didn't hold up, but just that it wasn't as good as I remembered it. But I think part of that might be the fact that I've been watching, I just watched the Pacific and Band of Brothers all like back to back. So that was kind of like the media headspace that I was in. And then I went to like artsy, like silent black and white movie. And I was like, yeah, this isn't it. But I don't think that's the movie's fault. So I don't want to say that it's not a good movie. I just don't think that I was in the right the right mental space to appreciate it as much on this viewing. But it is pretty good. It has, I think, if I remember correctly, two, maybe three scenes that have sound. Well, the whole movie has sound, like music, but that has like actual sound that's diegetic sound that's happening in the story.
Okay.
And one of the scenes that I actually really did appreciate was the scene where he's kind of contemplating the idea of a talkie, of a movie with sound, and he's in his like dressing room office and like knocks something over and it clatters, and he like knocks a chair over and it clatters, and the dog is barking and you can hear the wind and all the ladies laughing, but every time he tries to say something it's completely silent and he's like screaming and it's completely silent. Yeah. But you have all of this, like, you can hear his footsteps though as he's walking. I thought that was kind of cool. That was a really creative way to show how he was feeling about the impending doom in his eyes of the popularity of talkies.
Yeah, and I always think it's kind of fun to think there are exactly two silent Best Picture winners: Wings, the very first one, and then The Artist randomly in 2011. Which, I mean, has some few talking moments, but I would still say, I mean, it is a silent film. Like, it is.
Yeah, there's like, I think it's like two spoken lines in the whole movie, right? It's like right at the very end, John Goodman says, like, can you do that one more time?
Well, it's almost even kind of like a silent Bob moment or something.
Exactly.
Where at the end, because you actually don't realize he has a accent until the very last line of the film, when they want to roll again, and he says, with pleasure. With a French accent.
Which makes it makes a lot more sense then when you see that, because the whole time it's like, well, just...
You're like, why was he struggling? Right.
Right, just do the talkies, man. Like, you're already a movie star.
Right.
Just start talking. But exactly. It makes sense if he's insecure about his accent and his voice that he wouldn't want to.
Yeah. So, yeah. So let's kind of stick with The Artist here first then. So, yeah, it's a 95/87 on Rotten Tomatoes. And you were asking, so I did have it as number 5 when I did the movies of 2011. So I liked it a lot. I wasn't upset when it won Best Picture, but this was the year I absolutely loved Midnight in Paris.
Mm.
So that was just kind of one of my favorites of the decade. And then at the Oscars themselves, I remember there being, this was kind of seen as like, the Green Book of, I mean, yeah, I guess it's fine, but come on, it's not Best Picture, blah, 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 was like a lot of the critics kind of thought.
Yeah.
But I'm also looking like, I don't know what else beats it, because that was honestly, one of the bigger contenders that I hated was Tree of Life that year.
Right.
Midnight in Paris, honestly, it probably should have been a legit contender. You had something like Moneyball, that was also Hugo, The Descendants, The Help, War Horse was the Spielberg one, and then Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which most people consider like actively a bad movie. So, like, what else was going to win this year?
Yeah, I don't know. But Hugo came out that year, which I think is probably, man, I don't know. There are some good movies that came out that year that I definitely like.
I'm saying they're good. They are good movies. But right. As far as if you're gonna say the Academy's gonna vote on one to win Best Picture, I don't see how many times. If you redo this vote today, what else wins? Moneyball, maybe? Like, I don't even know.
Yeah,
I think it's The Artist. I think The Artist still wins,
and it still wins. And it's, this is kind of something that was like beat to death at the time and since, but it's basically like the Oscar movie.
No, right. And it's kind of Oscar baity or whatever you
right, but like,
say.
Like, but like the most, this might be the most Oscar bait movie to ever bait the Oscars.
And man, I guess, no, I'm going to disagree, or at least push back a little bit on that. I feel like the true Oscar bait movies are the ones that are like, they're going for it, prestige style, and there's not really much else there besides they're going for it. This is more of a fun, cutesy premise. That, yes, works perfectly and aligns with the type of movies that the voters like, but, like, it doesn't feel false. Like, you can have this fun premise, and, yeah, you do it really well.
I guess that's a good point. It doesn't feel false. That is true. But it is, like, a, hey, all you people in Hollywood, here's a movie about how Hollywood is and, like, the legacy of Hollywood and how, like, it's the best and, like, old movies are really cool. And you get all those like old black and white movies that you grew up on, and all those black and white silent films that you got forced to watch in film school. Well, here's a movie about how that was all like, those are all the best ever.
Right. So here's an example of, I'm trying to think, when does this episode come? This episode probably comes out after the Oscars here. But so I kind of felt this way watching it a little bit. And then I heard some other people kind of saying the same thing. So like Bradley Cooper's film Maestro, that's a little more Oscar bait. Not that it's bad, but like, and his performance is really good in it. But like when I finished watching the movie, I was just like, that kind of felt like Bradley Cooper was just showing off.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, look what I can do kind of thing. Like, please give me the Oscar.
Yeah.
And then I heard of some people on other podcasts basically saying like, yeah, the dude desperately wants to win this actor and it's kind of getting gross. And again, not saying he's bad, but it's just like almost too much. I don't know. And the movie doesn't really do anything other than just give him a chance to show. You know what I'm saying? Like the plot is, let me be on screen acting it up, trying to get my Oscar, please.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, the Oscars happened last month when this comes out. So I will confidently say he didn't win. I thought there was some... So actually, speaking of Bradley Cooper, one of my notes on the artist here was, is this story just A Star Is Born?
Oh.
Because it's the young up-and-comer discovered by the established guy, and then she eclipses him as he fades into obscurity.
Right.
It's just A Star Is Born.
Right.
But I didn't notice it until this watching.
And then, except for this one has the happy ending, and in A Star Is... Well, spoiler alert, but in A Star Is Born, the suicide actually happens, and in this one, it doesn't happen because she stops it in time and then live happily ever after.
Right, I don't remember on the previous versions of A Star Is Born if they also end as tragically as the Bradley Cooper one. But I
don't know. I've only seen the Bradley Cooper one.
I'm guessing probably or at least close. But yeah, it's a very similar story. Actually, you know what? I'm pretty sure there might be like four versions. I think I've seen like a version from the 30s or 40s that was nominated for Best Picture. And I don't even remember the details beyond that. Because I think there's a Judy Garland one, and then there was like a Barbara Streisand one, but there might actually be one before the Judy Garland one. I'd have to double check that. There's 1.2 where she's kind of just becoming a star, and he's just still trying to get funding for continuing to do silent films. And they meet in the stairwell of the studio, and I thought that was a pretty spot-on metaphor. He's literally going down as she's ascending. And I'm like, okay, that's... And I mean, it almost sounds cheesy when you point it out, but it's not played that way in the film. But it's one of those layers that definitely... it was definitely intentional that they catch each other going opposite directions on the staircase there. So I thought that was kind of a nice touch. But yeah, the story is all fictional. My last note is just that when he is... he's kind of frustrated, and this isn't even, I don't think, suicide attempt. This is he's frustrated and starts setting fire to some of his old film reels, and it catches the whole house on fire.
Right.
And his dog runs out and gets the policeman to come back and rescues him, and it's all kind of cutesy there or whatever. And that's when Pepe is the girl who's now a star and has means, and she goes to the hospital, and they're like, oh, he just needs rest. And she says, well, he's unconscious. You think he can rest at my house? And my note was, isn't that kidnapping? he's comatose, and they let her take him home.
Yeah, but it was...
They're not married.
Yeah, but it's like 19... What year was that? It's like 1932?
1927. Like, well, 1927, but the whole idea is like all this stuff is happening in 1927. Or I guess that you're right. You're right. This could be after that now, right? That you're right. That's the switch. You're right. This might be early 30s by now. You're right.
But yeah, you know, it was almost 100 years ago, and things were just different back then. You could just do that. If you went to the hospital and found a guy who was comatose, you could just take him. That's your guy now.
Well, and my bad, she was famous.
Right.
So that means she's okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's not like a random person off this. Like, if something happens to him, they know it's, oh, yeah, the Pepe, whatever her name was.
Yeah.
Super famous actress. Yeah, she's the one who took him. Pepe Miller.
Okay, fair. Yeah, and then they do have the whole thing where, and again, I think that's kind of played very real. So, like, she's always been such a fan of his. They kind of have a meet-cute early in the movie where there's, like, a red carpet event, and she ends up kind of, like, falling to pick up like her purse kind of thing or whatever, and then ends up on the other side of the barricade, and all of a sudden she's standing with the star, and everyone's like, oh no, the audacity, but then he plays it off and like does the photo shoot with her, and that's kind of what kind of starts building her brand even before she's in films there.
Right.
So anyway, so she's always been a fan. And then when he's on Hard Times and has to like basically put his whole estate up for auction, she's now basically the richest person in Hollywood and has bought a lot of his stuff, not in an obsessive, creepy way, kind of just in a like, man, I'd hate for this to all go somewhere else kind of way.
Right.
And yeah, I'm a fan. And like, she almost really doesn't seem to have a plan with it. But then when he's convalescent at her house and starts getting up and walking around, he finds the room
right
with all of his stuff in her house.
Yeah.
And it rightfully creeps him the hell out.
Yeah.
Because, like, what is this? Like,
right.
You're collecting me, including now physically me.
Right. It's like misery. He thinks he's about to be...
Yes.
Kathy Bates with the hobbling.
Hobbled, yeah. Yeah. Oh, man, that would have been a fun turn.
You think it's like
we're
a
gonna
cute...
make some more movies together.
Yeah,
now.
You think it's like a cute, like Hollywood, you know, love story type movie that just hard right turn in the third act just to straight up horror movie.
Yeah. Side note: that's always been I haven't figured out the story I would want to do with it, but that's been an idea I've long had, is to do a, and I'm sure things like this kind of exist, but like do a straight up, not like Parasite, where like, you know, starts as like a lighthearted drama and twists into a thriller. Not that, more like it intentionally from the beginning is like rotating genres. Like it starts as like a comedy,
okay,
and then it's a thriller, and then it's an action movie, and then it's a romantic comedy. Like it's, and you know, pick your genres. Again, for it to work, I feel like you'd probably have to bookend it with a comedy, but intentionally, like every 15, 20 minutes, it transitions into a different type of movie, complete with like the shooting style, the acting style, the vibe.
Right,
like,
all the tropes, yeah.
Yes, all the, but still somehow threading the same story through those different genres and kind of bring it all full circle.
That would be kind of interesting.
It'd be a fun experiment. I've just never actually sat down to write anything beyond that premise. why don't we then, before we talk about Singing in the Rain, you were going to research a little bit on the technology itself for like what was actually happening in Hollywood that allowed us to go from silent films to talkies, like from a technological standpoint.
Yeah, so I found two really, really good YouTube videos that explained,
okay, good,
explained this the best. And I'm going to go and make sure that I shout out the channels. So one is called The Whole Equation, and they have a video called The Strange World of Early Sound Films. And then the other one is called Technology Connections, and he's got a video called Movies Made Sound with a Light Bulb. And so basically they were talking about like the transition from silent films to talkies, and then kind of what was happening technologically that made that possible. So basically, the idea of having a movie that had sound to go with it has existed as long as either one of those technologies has existed. Like, people were trying
to... For synchronous, though?
People were trying to put them together.
Oh, right. Which makes sense. You want to capture the whole thing.
Right. There were just obstacles. So, number one was synchronizing them. So, getting them to play at the same time. Because if you, you know, just because you start a record and a projector at the same time doesn't mean that they're not going to drift apart from each other, and
right,
then it would be, you know, basically unwatchable.
Right.
The other thing is that in the early days of sound, when silent films were really big, electrical amplification of sound didn't exist yet. So because it was just, you know, you had like the old school record player with basically the big trumpet shaped thing on the end.
Right, right. Phonograph kind of thing. Yeah.
That was how you made the sound. And so you can't play one little old school tiny record player for an entire theater of people. You just can't hear it. So there was no way to amplify the sound to make it, you know, watchable for more than one person at a time. And then on the other side, on the production side, recording sound was super difficult. So it was all like omnidirectional microphones. You had to be super close to them.
Right. You could record sound. You just couldn't record the sound of the video you were also recording at the same time.
No, you could, but like you would have,
well, I guess you
would
could,
have to be like
be,
really close,
yeah,
to the microphone like this for anything to be heard at all. So if you have, you know, four people having a conversation, you would have to have a microphone in front of each one of them. And so if you're trying to tell a story where those guys are supposed to be like bank robbers or something. It doesn't make sense for them to all have microphones right in front of their faces.
Ooh, so they could have done like a 1915 talkie if the story was about a podcast.
Exactly. Yes. That's basically the extent of of how that would have gone. And so basically the transition from silent films to talkies were these technological advancements that allowed for synchronization, number one. So that was like could be mechanical synchronization at first, but then eventually became sound on film, which was something that I didn't even know existed. That was just a blank spot in my perception of the universe. Was, oh,
the sound is actually recorded on the film reel, right?
Right. When you would play a movie, I was like, oh yeah, they probably like have like a CD player or something, or you just press play on this at the same time and they go. No, the film itself has the sound information on the film.
Yeah, and that was the 1927 switch, basically.
So that went all the way back to that time, back to the 1920s. They were able to record sound on film, and it would either be a waveform that you could look and see the waveform on the side of the film, and it would either be just like, you know, the sound is white and the silence part is black, so it looks like, I mean, I have Audacity open right now. You know, that waveform would be, you know, a black and white thing on the side of the film. The other way is it could be the different amplitudes of sound could be like different shades of gray. So like silence would be black, super loud would be white, and then shades of gray for in between. And actually, the Technology Connection channel was talking about how because of the way that that's read by the light sensor, either one of those could be was compatible with the same film projector. So if you had a film projector that could read one, it could read both. And then later on, in the 80s and 90s, you get digital sound, which is actually like, it looks like a QR code between the sprocket holes on the film.
Oh, no way.
And so it was like, it would be a bit stream of data that's on these little codes in between the sprocket holes that was read by a little camera type apparatus. And that was how you would have digital sound then. To go along with film. It also, this is something that the Technology Connection channel was talking about was, so because you have the projector that has to read both the image and the sound was actually a few frames ahead because it would be read at a different part on the projector.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal to sync those up.
That makes editing a pain.
Well, it wasn't that big of a deal to sync those up. You know, the sound for, like, image for frame X would just be at frame X plus
X-3.
26 or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's one of the reasons why they have the MPAA little title card things, you know, the little green thing, this preview has been approved for all audiences. Because when you're splicing trailers together, you have to have that space for the sound to be able to sync up. And that's silence. That green screen is silence. So it allows you to have just a blank something so the screen isn't just black. They could put something up.
You needed something anyway, so might as well have that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, nowadays you probably wouldn't, but it's almost just kind of then grandfathered in.
I guess, yeah. It's like but that was like, it acted as something to put up on the screen that was silent for like a second or two, and then the sound would start.
Oh, that's funny. Because, yeah, I never thought about that. Like, that's kind of unnecessary.
Yeah.
Or, like, it's meaningless, but they always have them. It's like, yeah, that's how you know a trailer's coming.
Right. And then just a couple things about, like, the early days of talkies. So in that whole equation video, the guy's talking about why you see all these silent films that have, you know, elaborate camera movements, pretty elaborate editing, you know, dolly shots, push-ins, pull-outs, like all this cool camera work. And then so that's like silent movies. And then you would think, oh, and then when you get into talking movies, like, you know, you would expect this advancement, but it almost is a regression visually. You add the sound, but then everything's stationary. There's very few cuts. There's almost no camera movement. You have the, you know, weird aspect ratios. You got actors that are like half out of frame. And the reason is because with the microphones that they're using, they're omnidirectional, so they pick up sound from every direction, which means that they would pick up the voices, but also the very loud camera that's shooting the scene. And so they would have to put the cameras in these big, like, soundproof boxes, but then you can't move the camera. So you could shoot a scene with like three or four different cameras if you wanted to get stuff, you know, to be able to cut them together, because the sound was being recorded, you know, as a separate track. And so that had to maintain its integrity. So you couldn't have, you know, each camera wasn't recording sound. It was only recording the video. And so because you have these cameras that are in these big boxes, you can't move them. And so that's why you have like the scenes that where it's like three guys sitting there. And instead of being like, you know, a close up of this guy talking and then, you know, like a shot, reverse shot, it's just a scene, three guys having a conversation. And it's like, well, this, like the Charlie Chaplin movie that I just watched that had no sound, the camera works immaculate. They got these special effects, like cool, you know, tracking shots and stuff. And then I'm watching this movie, this talking movie, and it's literally just a uncut shot of three guys talking. The fact that those microphones were also not the best quality and didn't pick up sound very well is another reason why actors from that time, it looks like they're doing bad acting, and why they have that stereotypical like late 20s, early 30s cadence and diction is because the actors were taught to speak very slowly and enunciate every single thing that you say so that it would translate well when the audience is watching it, because the sound recording wasn't the best. So you couldn't have, you know, you couldn't mumble, you couldn't whisper, you had to project. It was almost like stage acting, but like even worse.
Right. Yeah, because that was my thought, I mean, yesterday as I was kind of like preparing for this, was like, why didn't they just do plays filmed early on? And even that would have been kind of probably too restrictive with the technology. I was going to give a shout out here to the Shea Cinema podcast. They're the ones doing all the Best Picture nominees, oh, yeah. The father and daughter, yeah, that are going through. They started from year one of the Academy Awards, talked about every nominee, and they're kind of doing every year. So each season is a different year of the Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. Well, when you get to, so the first year is all silent films. And they're basically all really good movies. I think there was like one, they're like, eh, but then the other five like are all really solid. You know, that's Wings, but that's also stuff like Sunrise. Mm-hmm. And I think Seventh Heaven was one that Sarah Shea really liked in particular. But when you get to the second year, it's now all or almost all talkies. And basically all the movies are worse. And it's kind of exactly what you're saying. So what they talked about on there was how the silent era essentially ended on the high. The making of silent films had reached its peak, and you were getting the best silent films ever. And then because the technology, the novelty of the technology, and that's where everyone wanted to go play in this new field, because that's what was going to bring the audiences in for the novelty. But then because all the technological restrictions you're talking about, and that they show in like Singing in the Rain, that the artist doesn't really talk about, the movies just weren't as good.
Right.
And so it kind of takes a while for, so you look at some of the, if you look, and I meant to go through this and I didn't have time. If you looked at like the Rotten Tomato ratings on Best Picture nominees, and you're like, we're going to graph it, it starts pretty good in 1927 or whatever, right before, even with the first Academy Awards, then kind of plummets and then slowly works its way back up. And there are a few exceptions. I think the third Best Picture winner was All Quiet on the Western Front, which we've talked about on this podcast before, and it's great,
right?
But it was an exception.
Right.
It was one of the few great early silent films.
Yeah.
Talkies.
Well, and that's why it makes, when you take into consideration how like stunted visually that early sound limitation makes those movies, it makes way more sense why you would see, you know, people at the time saying, oh, well, this is just a fad. No one's going to, like, these talkie movies are not going anywhere.
Right, because we're making inferior stories.
Right. Because, like, right. I just watched The Gold Rush, and that movie is awesome. And then I watched this, you know, random talkie movie, and it's a shot of three guys talking, yeah, and they're not talking well. And, you know, it's like, there's no music. It's like, this is not going anywhere. Like, no one is going to want to watch these.
Right. Let's go back to the better movies, please.
Right. Yeah. Which today, looking back, is like, okay, you know, that's ridiculous. Of course the talking movies are going to take off.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the time with the limitations of the technology, it was definitely better just to make the silent movie and use title cards or just have you know, someone like a Buster Keaton or a Charlie Chaplin, who's just such a good actor for this, you know, the silent films that they're in, they can convey that emotion. They can convey, you know, the comedy without having to say anything at all. And then one more thing. So the cameras having to be in those boxes, eventually those boxes got smaller and they actually made like big soundproof cases for the cameras. And apparently that was one of the things that led to the invention of the crane, because the cameras, even though they weren't in a giant booth anymore, they were still super cumbersome and heavy. And so they would attach them to these big cranes to make them easier to move. And then that's where you get like the crane shot, which is like one of the most iconic types of shots in movies where, you know, you have the, it's moving right across and then it, you know, pans out and goes, you know, high up in the sky. And you can see like huge areas of, you know, of the set. That was basically an invention of necessity because of how heavy the cameras were, because they had these big soundproof boxes around them so that they weren't being picked up on the microphones.
Oh, that's funny. It's like, hey man, these cameras are huge. We need an easier way to move them. Oh, hey, this easier way to move them also gives us cool new angles we hadn't thought about before.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, with the new technology thing, it made me think of, you're too young for this, but when the internet was new, I remember thinking, like, I was less enamored with it because of the speed. Now, again, I wasn't saying, like, oh, it'll never catch on, it's just a fad. I remember, I probably even said out loud to my friends, whatever, this will be cool when it's faster.
Yeah.
Because it was just so slow. Like, the idea you would click, you know, an early IMDb page and have to wait, you know, 30 seconds for the, I'm like, it's like, whatever, I'm not, I don't have the time for this. This is kind of lame.
Right.
It'll be better when it's faster.
Yeah. Well, and a similar thing happened with the advent of like computer animation. So like there are early computer animated movies. I mean, there have been animated movies like hand-drawn animation for, you know, forever, but computer animation, like, early computer animation looks like trash. It doesn't look good. Like all the shapes are very like geometric and everything kind of moves weird. And so it would be very easy to see someone in the 80s, for instance, say, oh yeah, this computer animation stuff, it's not going anywhere. Like it's kind of cool that they're able to make these shapes move or whatever, but it's, you know, I don't see this, you know, taking over the industry anytime soon. And then, you know, Toy Story comes out in what, 95? 96, something like that.
Right.
And, yeah. And it's like, oh, actually, this is going to be a massive revolution. And then, you know, today Pixar is like huge and some of the biggest movies of all time have been completely computer animated. And not to mention, most of your live action movies are now computer animated anyway because of all the CGI.
Oh, like when they talk about the relatively recent quote live action Lion King or Jungle Book or whatever, and it's just like, no, those are animated.
Right.
They're just photorealistic animation.
Exactly.
But it's like, it's still animated.
Right.
Oh yeah, but it's crazy to think, to your point, that now hand drawn animated movies are rare.
Right.
I mean, not they're not extinct. People still make them, but you can just do, there's so much more versatility with the computers nowadays, and you can do more in less time and just as well. It just has a different way to get there. Yeah, no judgment. I guess some people would be like, oh, that's kind of sad. I'm like, well, I mean, it's sad we don't have silent movies or, you know, horses to get around the country anymore. I don't know. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
At some point, it's still art. People are still coming up with stuff. Of course, then you're going to get into AI animation, and it's like, oh, no one even has to like do it in the computer. You just tell the computer or teach the computer how to, hey, come up with a story about a rabbit who likes a pig, and then it's like it just animates the whole thing for you.
Yeah.
So yeah, Singing in the Rain actually focuses more on the technical limitations. So in The Artist, they kind of just like, hey, we're moving on. She's become a talking film star, and he is not. And it's kind of more about the rise and the fall switch of those two individuals in kind of this friendship kind of romance thing. Versus Singing in the Rain deals with multiple facets. It's kind of dealing with the writers and the creators and the technology of how some stars cannot carry over because of how they talk. Specifically, like I said, the woman who was nominated for Best Actress, and how she has the very kind of grating, obnoxious voice. But specifically, when they're first trying to get this all to work, they kind of have their whatever studio they are all working for is doing exactly what you're saying. They're trying to figure out how to transition to the talkie era so they don't get left behind. and they're kind of basically taking existing productions and turning them into talkies mid-production. And so, but then they're trying to figure out how to like hide the microphones on set and the issues they're having, which it sounds like may not have been entirely correct if you're saying that the microphones are omnidirectional. So the issue they have in Singing in the Rain, that they play for laughs, which is why I'm not sure if it's accurate or not, is wherever they put the mic, as the actors turn their head, the sound goes up or down depending on if they're facing the mic or not.
Oh, right.
So their issue was not picking up too much. Their issue was picking up too little. But was that maybe not necessarily an issue, or is it could have been briefly?
Well, if the microphone is omnidirectional, like if you put it over there, if you put it on this side and I talk towards it, it's going to hear me. If I turn away, then it won't. So that is still...
Oh, okay. Okay, so that is the issue. Okay, yeah. So yeah, they kind of play for laughs, and they're putting the microphone in all different places. Like, they're trying to sew it up into her dress so it's right there. But even then, if she turns her head, it ends up being kind of a... Because basically, ADR, you know, additional dialogue recording or recording stuff after the fact and trying to sync it up wasn't necessarily a thing yet. You kind of had to catch it on set, I guess, right? I don't know how that would have worked back in the 20s. Did you guys see anything on that with...
like recording sound on set?
Or the opposite, recording sound after the fact that you could then put to your recording, the way they do now all the time.
Oh,
but
yeah. Well, I think in the early days, it was you had to get it all at once, which is where you would see, and you can go find like pictures and stuff of this, but like a film set where you have, you know, the set with the actors and then the cameras, and then like right behind the cameras is a whole orchestra. Because they have to capture the soundtrack, like the music,
oh, wow,
and the talking, you know, and the sound of it, like everything has to be captured at once, all at the same time.
Okay.
But then later on, then they do have, you get into sound mixing where you can record,
gotcha,
and then edit and mix the sound, you know, have the music be at a certain level and the voices be at a different level. And that was actually,
gotcha,
that's actually another reason why early silent films or early talking films are kind of trash is because sound mixing didn't exist yet. So whatever the levels were,
okay,
when you recorded it on set live is just,
yeah,
what they were.
Huh. Yeah, because obviously then the when they have that realization in the film that they need to have Debbie Reynolds dub in for the other actress, that, yeah, it must be enough later that the technology, because obviously they are doing that after the fact and having her dub over the lines. And I think maybe they even do it like a cheat way or something. I forget. They basically just have her do it again while she's watching the movie, and then she just records it, and then they play those together at the movie. And so they may have been cheating on what was technologically possible at the time, because obviously the movie's from 1952, and there could be a few things that they maybe got out of order. I mean, for example, the song Singing in the Rain is from 1929, and they're doing this all in kind of 1927 before the song itself was even written. So yeah, a few more notes on Singing in the Rain then, because we haven't really talked about it as much. So yeah, basically the main characters are stars and writers in the silent era and then transition again. The film actually opens in 1927 with like this big film opening. Gene Kelly is playing like the biggest movie star in the world at the time. They're at the opening, and I think it's probably still opening for a silent movie, and it's at Groundlings Chinese Theater, which was actually brand new when the film was set. So like ground broke on the Chinese Theater in 1926, and it opened in 1927. So it's actually kind of possible that this red carpet event at the beginning of Singing in the Rain is possibly meant to be like the opening of Groundlings Chinese Theater. And actually, I'm pretty sure I didn't do a deep dive on Sid Groman, but I think he's even tied to like the establishment of the Academy in these early Hollywood days here too. And because I don't think I've ever mentioned it on the History and Film podcast, I did see Free Solo at Grauman's Chinese Theater with Helen Hunt, which, I mean, I don't know Helen Hunt, but...
but she was there watching it at the same time.
No, right. And again, there was... It sounds like a silly thing to even mention, but like, no, there were like 12 people in the theater, and me and Helen Hunt were two of them. And I like walked right by her and her friends like in the lobby before the film, and like I didn't say anything. I don't want to be like, I just want to let her, you know, live her life or whatever.
Sure.
But I sat like just basically ended up being like two rows behind and, you know, three seats over from Helen. Like I was hearing her react during the movie Free Solo, which is kind of neat. And then it goes on to win the Oscar for best documentary. The other one I wanted to mention here, again, kind of just random notes since these stories are all fictional, but Gene Kelly's character repeatedly teases Debbie Reynolds' character by calling her Ethel Barrymore because Debbie Reynolds' character wants to become an actress. And basically the idea is that Ethel Barrymore is the biggest female star in 1927. So I'm going to tease you by saying you're Ethel Barrymore. It's kind of interesting how that does time out. So yes, she would have been a big star in 1927. We mentioned her brother John had a romance with Evelyn Nesbit in Ragtime. So John Barrymore is not in Ragtime, but he did date Evelyn Nesbit, who's one of the main characters there. And then so I wanted to just briefly talk about the Barrymore acting family. Because obviously Drew Barrymore today is John's granddaughter and all those things. So it actually goes back to a Herbert Blythe, who was a British man born in India in 1849, but he later took the stage name Maurice Barrymore. And then he married a woman named Georgiana Drew. And they had three children. Lionel, who's best known as Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life, and he also won an Oscar in 1931. John, who we mentioned, who was more known for his stage and silent film work, although he was actually younger than Lionel, but Lionel was kind of known for playing older people. And then Ethel was their sister, and she was kind of big throughout, from like stage, silent film, talkies. Ethel kind of stayed a star the whole time. So even in like the years leading up to the film Singing in the Rain in 1952, she had been nominated for four Oscars in the 6 years leading up to that, including one win. But even by 1927, she was already well established. So basically, a decades long star is Ethel Barrymore. Basically, she was Meryl Streep and Katharine Hepburn before Meryl Streep and Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
We had Ethel Barrymore. Like, you can almost say, like, those are like the three mega stars of these 30, 40 year chunks.
Like, generational. Yeah.
Yes. Like, it's Ethel Barrymore into Katharine Hepburn into Meryl Streep.
Right.
It's like she's probably on that tier.
And I wonder if, which we've kind of talked about this before with the dehomogenization of culture, I wonder who or even if there will be like another.
Oh, because you almost can't be anymore.
Who the next one is. Yeah. Because I would say right now it's probably still Meryl Streep, even though it's been Meryl Streep for the last 30, 40 years.
Right. Since the 80s. Yeah. No, right. It's harder to be a star, but I guess you could still stand out with Hollywood success. If you're going to say an Emma Stone kind of keeps killing it for the next 30, 40 years, even if she's not as big a star as Katharine Hepburn was,
yeah,
she could have similar success in movies.
Right. I just mean like someone who's like ubiquitous in like all the prestige movies and who is basically the gold standard by which everyone else measures their career success. I mean, like, no one's going to touch a Katharine Hepburn or a Meryl Streep, you know, career success-wise. It's like, how close can you get to that is how you determine how successful you are. So I wonder, like, who the next one would be, because it would be someone who's in movies right now.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of serious with Emma Stone. Now, again, we're recording this after the Oscars, and she either won Best Actress for Poor Things or, just got narrowly beat out by Lily Gladstone. That's going to be my prediction there, because she's only, like, 36 and already has, like, four or five Oscar nominations, one for La La Land, might have just won last month for Poor Things. And again, is like, if you look at Meryl Streep at 36, I don't know if she was as far along.
Yeah.
As far as all that goes.
Yeah.
So, and because she shies away from, Emma Stone's not going out and doing the Marvel stuff.
Right.
She's choosing challenging, interesting, again, she's working with Yorgos Lanthimos, and like, she's choosing these kind of interesting filmmakers to work with and interesting, challenging things, and doesn't care about, I mean.
She hasn't done any like big, like tentpole franchise movies. She hasn't done a Marvel or a Star Wars or, well, I guess she was in the Amazing Spider-Man movies, but.
Oh, true.
Like, it was just.
And I'm not saying you can't do that stuff too.
Right. It was just like two, and she's not like a Chris Hemsworth where everyone's like, oh, Emma Stone, you mean Mary Jane Watson? Or I guess she was Gwen Stacy.
Oh, right.
You know, it's not like a Chris Hemsworth. It's like, oh, yeah, Thor. I say Thor, and it's like, that's who that is. you know, or Tom Hiddleston with like Loki. It's like, that's just kind of what he's, even if he does right. other stuff later, like that's who he is.
I think self-consciousness was what I was trying to come up with. Her lack of self-consciousness. She's just willing to get, well, you have probably seen Poor Things yet.
I have not. I want to.
Definitely, she does not care what people think. She's just going to go for it and kind of kills it.
Okay.
So I was going to try to pull up I was going to see how many Oscar nominations she has versus how many Meryl Streep had at this point at the same age. So it's a stone cold lock. She's going to get nominated for Poor Things. That'll be her fourth, and she's 35. And with one win. And then Meryl Streep, obviously, who has like the insane record for nominations, but let's see, she is 75, or she'll turn 75 this year.
Which is crazy.
Right, right. Did you see her in Only Murders in the Building?
Yes. Have you watched all the seasons of
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I'm caught up with all
of Oh my gosh, yeah, yeah. I love that show so much. We for the last two seasons we've watched like as they drop. My wife and I've watched them as they drop. Like we're huge fans of that show.
Oh, nice. And so I was listening to an interview with Selena Gomez, and she was talking about Steve Martin's take on it. Basically like, oh, how long are we going to do this? Basically, like, Steve doesn't want to stop. He's like, we're going to keep doing this show forever.
That's great.
Like, Steve wants to keep doing it forever.
I'll watch it forever. I love that show so much. I can't get enough. Like, the dynamic of, like, the old boomers and then, like, Selena Gomez, I love that. And I just love Steve Martin and Martin Short comedy is like, it's such like a nostalgic, like throwback style of comedy. And I just get a kick out of it. And seeing them like doing the podcast struggles too, where they're like coming up with ideas and they'll like stop and record their little voice notes into their phone and stuff. Like that's just so much fun.
Yes. Yes. Hang on. I think I got it here. They're close. Yes, so 79. But yeah, basically they are tied. When
oh wow,
like at 35. Yeah, the year Meryl turned 35, she got her fourth nomination and had one win, the same as Emma. So she's actually at the same point that Streep was at this point. Although I mean, I remember saying the same thing though about Kate Winslet, and she's still an amazing actress. But she has not been nominated for Oscars at the same clip she was
right.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
Although Meryl probably has. Actually, let me see. What's the biggest drought that Meryl had without an Oscar nomination?
Oh man.
I found a five. And that is. So 5 years is her biggest gap. Going back to 1979.
All right. Just for comparison, I want to see what the biggest Daniel Day-Lewis drought is. It's probably bigger.
Well, for the smallest might be 5 years. Well, because he doesn't work as much.
That's true. He's not churning the movies out like Meryl Streep is. Oh, okay.
He doesn't work often enough.
He only has six nominations.
He'd go 5 years without making a movie.
Now, granted, he's 3 for 6. He's batting right. 500.
His batting average is insane
on best right. actor nominations. But he's only, I mean, yeah, going all, I mean, his first one was 1989, his most recent one was 2017. So it's been 7 years
oh, man.
Since he was nominated.
Here's a crazy, man, we're all over the place now. The side note that just occurred to me, my brain, is, so I remember in high school history class that, so Mr. Tallman, he didn't do this all the time, but I don't know if it was like a for a semester final or something, but he did a certain test. I swear it might have even been the semester final, and it was like a really, really long test. You weren't actually expected to get all the way through it, and he would just grade it all on the curve afterwards, and basically you got a point for every question you got right, but you lost a point for every question you got wrong.
Right, yeah, okay.
So you basically had to make sure I'm only answering the stuff I'm certain about.
Yeah.
So basically what I'm getting, I'm making a Daniel Day-Lewis versus Meryl Streep comparison.
Ah, okay.
So I ended up with like the second highest score in the class because I answered 40 questions and got them all right. I'm Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
And then one of my classmates was Meryl Streep. He answered like 120 and missed 20.
Right.
So he did outscore me, but he was swinging a lot more, yeah, even if he was going to be wrong.
Yeah, it's like taking the ACT versus the SAT, where the ACT, you don't get penalized for wrong answers, but the SAT, you do.
Right, so it changes how you gotta, right, you can't be guessing, you gotta know. Anyway, where were we?
We were talking about...
Ethel Barrymore.
Oh, yeah. I was like, how did we get here?
Anyway, so yes, she's referenced in Singing in the Rain. They also do mention the film, The Jazz Singer, throughout. So, like, even though the story in Singing in the Rain is fictional, they're constantly referencing The Jazz Singer because it's basically why Hollywood is wanting to transition, because The Jazz Singer is crazy popular as the first... It's not actually a feature-length talkie in the sense that it's not a talkie the whole thing,
right,
but it's the first feature film to feature talkie segments, and not just like synchronized sound with like a dance scene, which it does have those. I think there's probably elements of those where if you had a band playing in 1925, yeah, you know what, there's probably music on the score too that kind of roughly matches, but it's not the same band playing that same song recorded on set. It's more just like they added it in after the fact and kind of synced it up, but not dialogue. The Jazz Singer actually has extended scenes where, yes, he's playing the piano, and we are hearing the performance he is recording on this video. That's significant. But then during that, he's also then talking to his mother and having a conversation, and it is now a filmed record. Like, it's synced up. We're hearing what they recorded on set. Oh my gosh, this is crazy. And so then all of Hollywood's like, that's going to be so popular. I'm a studio head. Quick, we got to retrofit and change all our stuff to talking, because that's where it's going. And then this kind of, again, it's Singing in the Rain is more like more of a comedy based around all that. And then almost a little bit of a Star Is Born segment then here too, where Debbie Reynolds goes from being the voice of the star who's the face of the picture, and they're trying to figure out how to transition her into becoming the star herself, since she's the one with the talent. So kind of the big, I'm going to spoil Singing in the Rain, the big reveal on the end is the star who has the bad voice ends up basically wanting to, like, she's going to threaten to sue the studio if they take away her stuff for, like, you need me, I'm the voice, and I have a contract and all these kinds of things, blah, 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 blah. She's kind of like strong-arming the studio and seems to have all the cards, but she's enough of a attention seeker. She wants to go out on stage in front of the live audience after they show the movie to kind of like talk to the crowd. And normally they try to stop her because she's obnoxious and has this grating voice. And they're like, oh yeah, go ahead, knock yourself out. And so the crowd's like, oh, sing us a song. And she can't do it because she sucks. And they're like, oh, quit fooling us. Sing it for real. And then so they're like, fine. Gene Kelly says, I'm going to make Debbie Reynolds go and lip sync for you again, or you're going to lip sync while Debbie sings. I forget the character's name, so that's why I'm calling them Gene and Debbie. But Debbie's actually like super pissed at him because, like, I said I wasn't going to do that anymore. I want to be my own actress. And he's like, you got to do it. You're under contract. And she's super pissed, but they're basically tricking both of them. And they raise the curtain while the song is being played, and so the whole crowd can see that Debbie is actually singing.
Right.
So it screws over the established star without technically breaking contract, because she's now been exposed, and then Debbie gets to have the credit and the fame going forward because they see that she actually has the talent. And just because, I'm sure not all of our audience knows, but Debbie Reynolds is the mother of Carrie Fisher, who played Princess Leia.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see, because they're actually probably similar age. Like, Debbie Reynolds in Singing in the Rain is probably pretty close to the same age that Carrie Fisher was in the first Star Wars film. And they kind of have that similar kind of energy to them. I don't think they look a lot alike, but you can definitely kind of see it. And then I always think it's neat when you can hear it in the voice just a little bit.
Yeah.
Where there's just certain times where you can kind of hear, like, Debbie will say a line in just the way, and you're like, oh, that sounds just like Carrie would say that same kind of line. So, so that's always kind of fun. Let's see. I had another note here about how the song Singing in the Rain was used in A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yep. It sure was.
I don't really have anything beyond that. I saw some headlines that Gene Kelly wasn't very happy without that. And I'm pretty sure I'd heard before. I didn't look all this up ahead of time, but I want to say that Malcolm McDowell might have even, like, improvised that on set that it was just something was just off, and so Stanley Kubrick is like, I mean I forget the story, but I'm pretty sure Malcolm improvised
it. I think I've heard that, because wasn't there something about how, like, after he did that, then they had to go and get the rights for that song or something, like they weren't planning on.
Yeah.
I think I've heard that before.
Okay. Yeah, I should have looked up the whole thing there. The other thing, I also wrote down the word folly. So in the teens and 20s, you had something like the Follies. Specifically, the famous one was Ziegfeld Follies, and there was even a Best Picture, I think maybe even winner, called The Great Ziegfeld, about the guy who established those Follies. And so I kind of just wanted to talk about what that term meant. We kind of already know, like, oh, that's sheer folly. So folly just means foolishness. And so the Follies, if you were going to go to watch the Follies, they were kind of live productions, but they were just lighthearted song and dance and comedy shows. And the most famous folly in the U.S. were the Ziegfeld Follies that ran on Broadway from 1907 to 1931. And they were based off of similar French shows that went back a few decades earlier. And then I also had my notes to mention Josephine Baker, just so I can say we officially mentioned her if we want to consider her later for most interesting person in American history, because she was kind of a big star in the Follies. Is over in France in the film Midnight in Paris, makes a cameo. Like, there's kind of like, oh, that's Josephine Baker. She's over there kind of singing. And then, because I think she also like was helping out with World War II after that. So again, don't have time to mention her any more than that today, but I'm just going to say I'm going to nominate her down the line when we talk about most interesting people in American history. Josephine Baker does need to be considered. And so, yeah, just because they do mention it, and it's kind of the third movie in this trifecta here. So the jazz singer, now it's only it's a 78/56 on Rotten Tomatoes. It is available for free to watch on Tubi. There is a disclaimer at the beginning because the film does feature blackface and the use of Al Jolson is singing in blackface for basically the last third of the movie. But so I do think they have a disclaimer, which I think that's the way to do it. They basically say, hey, there are things in this film that are objectionable, but we believe that historical context is important. And so right on Tubi, I think that is the way to do it. I disagree with Disney basically just eliminating something like Song of the South from their catalog on Disney Plus. I think you should put it up there and you have a disclaimer.
Yeah, the disclaimer is definitely better than just eliminating it, but like, I don't know. To me, even the disclaimer, I think, is a little.
Well, I don't mind it because if you don't have the disclaimer, it could be said that you still actively support this kind of.
Oh, art. You're saying it could be, if you don't have the disclaimer, it could be misconstrued that the inclusion of it on your streaming is tantamount to, what's the word that I'm looking for? An endorsement.
Promoting it.
Yeah.
Endorsement. Right.
Okay.
Right.
I guess I can see that.
So yeah, I think you provide the context. That goes, so like there's, and again, I haven't heard anything about this recently, but there's, you know, people that would talk about editing the N-word out of Huckleberry Finn. And it's like, well, but like, this is one of the greatest novels in American history. Some people consider it the greatest American novel, Huckleberry right. Finn.
And it's set in the, I don't know what year, but definitely a time where that would have been a word in the common parlance. So it's like, you don't want to whitewash that.
Right, right, right. It's basically set in Reconstruction or post-Reconstruction, you know, South. And I think someone did, I never read it, but someone did, I think kind of to prove a point, and maybe we even mentioned this before, but they actually, because it's a public domain now,
right?
They replaced every instance of the N-word with the word robot. And but even put then like drawings, and so it's Huck on this adventure with Robot Jim.
Oh,
but apparently that's the only change. Like, it's the exact text of Huckleberry Finn with the N-word replaced with the word robot, and Jim is now a robot.
Huh.
in theory, it also could then deal with the idea of how we treat robots in the future and AI, and you know,
right?
Yeah. Almost kind of making a political statement about that. Anyway, so in The Jazz Singer, basically the main character, played by Al Jolson, and it's a fictionalized version, I forget his name, he gets nicknamed kind of Ragtime Jackie. He's a Jewish boy in New York whose dad is kind of a is very conservative. His dad might even be the rabbi. And he's very conservative, wants his son to become a cancer. Oh, sorry, dad probably is a cancer, which is basically the person who sings from the Torah in front of everybody. So not the rabbi, but the person who comes in to sing this, whatever they, I don't know if they call it scripture, but to read the Torah,
right?
And but sing it. They're specifically, you're singing it. And Jackie's really talented singer. So his dad's like, you need to take over and be the next cancer. Like, we come from a long line of cantors. You're next. But Jackie likes the ragtime music, which we've talked about in ragtime. It kind of predates jazz, and it's, you know, very upbeat, big piano stuff. To the point he basically gets, his dad basically disowns him because he won't give up that singing. And people are like telling his dad, like, oh, he was down in the, you know, the bar, the, you know, whatever, just kind of, he's making a mockery of your family kind of thing. So his dad disowns him. But that's where he ends up becoming famous and getting more and more successful as a ragtime singer. It cuts years. He basically leaves home as a kid, cuts to later, and he's in London and he's singing. And we get kind of the first sound integrated scene when he's doing a show in London. And between songs, and this is, I think it's even on probably like the AFI 100 years, 100 quotes kind of list. So it's one of the all time famous lines. And he says, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet.
Right.
And so it kind of goes into play as another song, but the idea that he speaks that line, and yeah, the crowd cheers, and you kind of think that, like, yeah, if people were watching the jazz singer, that would have been like, holy cow, like, it's, you can see you getting caught up in the moment in an audience in 1927, yeah. And you're just like, mind is blown, like, the, because Al Jolson was like one of the biggest music stars at the time.
Right.
Separate from movies, and now he's playing a musician in this movie. You can see this like being a huge, yeah, huge deal in audiences at the time.
Well, because at the time, if you wanted to see your favorite musical artist perform a song, you had to see them in person.
Well, right.
So, like, the vast majority, right, of people probably lived their entire life, and, you know, if they, you know, listened to music at all, they only ever heard audio, never saw a performance from their favorite, unless they, you know, happen to be touring through their area or whatever. But then the fact that you could just, like, watch it on a screen, like, that's completely new. No one had ever seen that before. It's hard to overstate how powerful that would be.
Right. And it's, of course, what's funny is we're even getting a little bit of that today with, like, so, like, Taylor Swift. So you can be a giant fan of Taylor Swift and have all her albums, but maybe you can't afford to go to a concert or travel to a concert. But now they had her concert, like, in the movie theater last year, and that you could actually go and see her perform versus just listening to the CD or pulling up YouTube. You could actually watch the concert on a screen.
I don't know if it's quite
kind
the same
of, well, I'm saying it's kind of similar to the jazz singer.
Yeah, but you've seen,
right,
you've seen videos of her. You can watch, right, other videos of her performing live.
You're right. The added layer of, I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah.
Right. So it's that, but like times a million. Yeah. You're right. Okay. It's also crazy too how production timelines worked, and I don't know how. So this movie came out in 1927, and like when they show a letter in the film that he gets from back home or sends back home, like the letter is dated August 8th, 1927, and like the movie just comes out like 6 weeks later. Now, they could have filmed that ahead of time, but still, it almost makes me think they just kind of like, yep, that's how quick movies got made. So anyway, he's becoming a bigger star. He finally gets a gig back in New York. And the implication is he hasn't been back to New York City since he left home as a kid. We also hear, like, some of the background score music is, what's it called? We hear the song, Give My Regards to Broadway. Like, we don't hear the lyrics because the film is mostly silent. So this is kind of back in the silent part. But we hear kind of hints of that song, which I was like, oh, let me look up that song real quick. And I think we don't need to do every single movie. But so Give My Regards to Broadway was written by George M. Cohan, who is who James Cagney plays in Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Oh, okay.
So like that's all connected. So like, we didn't do Yankee Doodle Dandy. I guess we still kind of could, but in theory, we've kind of missed it on our timeline because he was kind of writing songs, you know, in the early 1900s here. But I didn't realize, and again, I've seen Yankee Doodle Dandy, but I guess I didn't realize, like, we know this dude's songs. Like, Give My Regards to Broadway, Over There,
right?
The Yankee Doodle Boy, which is the big one in Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then You're a Grand Old Flag. Like,
yeah,
the fact that I knew four and those are the ones they kind of list first on his Wikipedia page. But the idea that this guy that, you know, was writing these movies 100 or these songs 100 years ago, and we still kind of all know four of his songs. It's not like a one hit, like Camptown Races, which, you know, Stephen Foster, I guess he's got several too, yeah. But like that he's kind of that caliber. Anyway, and then, yeah, so then he can't, so his mom is like ready to embrace him back. Dad is still like, I can't believe you're still into this jazz, and because ragtime's kind of transitioned to the jazz. So by the 20s, like ragtime has become jazz. So hence the film titled The Jazz Singer. Mom's ready to embrace him, but dad still can't stand that he's doing this music and all these kinds of things. But then his big show on Broadway is him in blackface. And that's where it's, anyway, and we'll talk about more on the side notes there maybe with some of that stuff. But yeah, it's like the climactic performance of The Jazz Singer is him in blackface. And then there ends up being a debate. So his dad ends up kind of in poor health, and they kind of convince him like, oh, the only thing that'll bring him back or make him happy enough to keep living is if you perform as the cantor at the big, you know, thing at the synagogue tonight. Well, I can't. I've got my Broadway debut tonight. So it's kind of like you have to choose between your family and your career,
right,
kind of thing.
Which, I mean, that's something that I think has probably been in stories for a long time. But as far as in movies,
oh yeah,
that's something that you've seen a million times in a million different movies. That third
the
act.
Impossible choice.
The one thing is happening that's from your one life, and the other thing is happening from your other life at the exact same time, and you have to make the choice. That's like, that's like, we've talked about this a bajillion times, so I'm not going to beat it to death. But again, it's just another example of when you go back and watch these movies, keep in mind that, like, yes, that seems like a trope that's beat to death, but this was the first one to do it, movie wise, anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, the choice could have been, well, before, this is 1927. You could have silent films where you're making choices like
well,
that. But
yeah.
Yes, it was right. It was. It wouldn't have seemed like overdone at this point necessarily. Right. And then ultimately he kind of makes it all work. He does go perform at the synagogue, and then he goes back to put on his blackface and do the show and live happily ever after. And so when you look at the Rotten Tomatoes ratings of a 78/56, I'm not saying this movie is great, and it definitely doesn't hold up for the blackface reasons, and just kind of it's dated in a million other ways too. But if you were going to do the Rotten Tomatoes rating in 1927,
yeah,
this is probably like an 80/95.
Yeah.
Yeah, just it is probably worth watching for the historical context of all that. And I will mention blackface here, and then we'll talk about Al Jolson in 1927 on our side notes on Patreon. So blackface, again, basically, well, one, I was going to say white people, not always white people. There are some black people who wore blackface,
right,
as part of these shows. Yeah, so the act of blackface, painting the face black, usually then with lips being overly prominent to look ridiculously large. So it goes back to minstrel shows, which were basically an early stage equivalent to sketch comedy shows in like the mid to late 1800s.
Okay.
And yeah, white performers would put on blackface and thereby making African Americans the butt of the jokes in their comedy sketches. So like acting stupid and primitive to get the audience to laugh while wearing blackface. So it was utterly insulting and dehumanizing, and kind of lasted for decades before enough people kind of just started to speak up and say, hey, maybe this isn't the best thing. So people like Al Jolson and maybe other incidents weren't as cruel, but that it still had its ties back to this dehumanizing, ridiculing thing. So that's why it is so offensive.
Right.
Some people were just like, oh, well, he's just singing in, or like, you know, I think of like, you know, nowadays, if you know, like, oh, this 8-year-old is going to school as Martin Luther King Jr. For Halloween because he's a really big fan of Martin Luther King Jr. and everything he stood for. And so he wants to dress up like him, and he's putting on blackface. Quote, what's wrong with that? And it's like, well, no, yes, there's nothing wrong with the way this kid is thinking.
Right.
But because there is this context, because there is a historical context of people were doing that in a core, it's again, there's nothing inherently wrong with a swastika. But guess what?
Right.
You kind of can't wear swastikas anymore.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, for me, a good comparison for why you can't do blackface anymore. I agree, you could do it in a non-offensive way. just like I could wear a swastika in a non-offensive way and go back to, like, it's Indian roots that have nothing to do with Nazis, but the Nazis ruined it. So, yes, sorry, people in the late 1800s ruined blackface for the rest of us. Oh, we just got canceled, Logan. Sorry. So yeah, sign up for our Patreon.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, we just wanted to kind of do this episode, talk about this time period, this Hollywood transition. This is more of a history podcast, but again, I think for us as movie lovers, this was an important cultural time because basically Hollywood never went back. It's almost uncanny how abrupt the switch was. It wasn't like you had a sprinkling of talkies and then like it was a smooth gradient from silent film into talkies. Right. It's like, no, it was a brick wall. You had a few silent films after the talkie switch, but it basically went from 100% silent film to like less than 5% silent film in a year and a half. Like it was abrupt. Yeah. So yeah, I thought that was significant enough that it was worth talking about here. Well, I was going to kick everything else over to Patreon because we're kind of running out of time on the regular feed here. So yes, if you haven't already, patreon.com/historyandfilm. A few things for free over there. Other things kind of are behind the paywall. Just trying to help pay the bills, keep the lights on, so to speak. Today we're going to be talking about, the year 1927, beyond just movies. I'll talk a little bit about Al Jolson and maybe kind of then the roaring 20s a little bit in general as well. Although you could also refer to previous episodes when we talked about like Midnight in Paris and those things on our world history thing. And then, stay tuned next time and we should be getting to prohibition of alcohol and the kind of fight there with Al Capone in the film The Untouchables.
Hell yeah.